Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As the planet continues to warm, scientists have noticed the natural world's migration patterns changing. Migratory birds are migrating earlier and their ranges are moving north. Animal ranges are moving up in elevation and also north. Even plant life have been observed in new areas. But what of our forests? We tend to think of forest ranges as unchanging and at risk. Think of lodgepole pines decimated by bark beetles, ash trees in the upper Midwest devastated by the emerald borer, or giant sequoias endangered by massive forest fires that can reach their lofty crowns. But my guest today says forests are on the move through natural migration as well as human intervention. The question is, can they move quickly enough? Zach St. George is a science journalist who has written for The Atlantic, Scientific American, and Outside Magazine. He examines the health of our forests and the challenges they face from climate change, invasive pests, and man's insatiable need for wood products and space in his book, The Journey of Trees, a story about forests, people, and the future. In it, he focuses on the evolving forest through a few key species facing threats, the giant sequoia, the ash tree, black spruce, Florida torreya, and the Monterey pine, and looks at how some species thought to be doomed, like the American chestnut, are making a comeback. Again, the name of the book is The Journey of Trees. Zach St. George is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Zach St. George, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
The Journey of Trees tells the story of a few iconic species of trees and a larger story of the threats American forests are facing. Things like climate change, invasive pests, logging, and human encroachment. What made you want to tell this story about our American forest?
Yeah, about 4 or 5 years ago, I was living in California, and I learned that the sequoias, the giant sequoias in Sequoia National Park, were losing their needles. And at the time, California was in a major drought, and the scientists at the park had never seen that before. There was no records of the sequoias losing their needles before. So I went up there and met the scientists and spent time with those ancient trees. And they were starting to think, the scientists there were starting to think about, really for the first time, kind of a future where maybe those iconic trees, the giant sequoias, which the park is named for, maybe in the future they wouldn't actually be able to survive there. They were looking at this drought kind of as a possible vision of the future. And so that really set me down this path of exploring really the future of forests and particularly people's role in that future.
Of course, with sequoias, we're looking at a species that, you know, when you look at one of those trees, this is a tree that germinated maybe 2,500, 3,000 years ago. It's hard to imagine a world in which humans live where there aren't sequoias.
Yeah. You know, you go to those parks, you go to Sequoia National Park or Redwood National Park or really any place where there's a big old tree, and it sort of feels like it's eternal, like it's always been there and it always will be there. So part of what I was interested in was kind of recasting these sort of eternal, unmoving beings as actually quite mobile. Like every other species, they move around, and they have moved around, and they'll do so in the future. So I found that to be kind of an interesting way to look at them.
But certainly trees are not as mobile as animals, humans, or even smaller plants and shrubs.
Well, yeah, I mean, it takes a long time for a tree to grow up and produce seeds of its own, and for that, those seeds in turn to grow into trees of their own. So really the question at the beginning of the book is, should people move trees north to save them from climate change? You know, all over the world, scientists have observed tree species moving toward the poles and upslope, so seedlings sprouting in new places. And the question for a long time is, will they keep up with the rate of climate change? You know, as we're talking about, trees are pretty slow creatures, and the rate of climate change right now is really fast, and humans have cut off a lot of possible routes. And so the question is whether species will keep up, and if they don't, will they face extinction?
Now, you investigated that, and you were looking up a long tree line in various places, and what you found was that, yes, trees do migrate, but it's sort of a messy story. They move back and forth. They don't follow any sort of discernible rules.
Right. you know, if you think about the effects of climate change, it's kind of easy to imagine sort of everything stays in its present arrangement and simply moves north or moves up slope, moves towards the poles. But really, we can see from the fossil record that things are not quite so orderly. Really, what happens is you have certain species become more common, certain species become less common. You have kind of novel ecosystems with different groups of species living together. So yeah, at Treeline, I visited some sites where scientists have sort of observed this happening today, where you know, new species are kind of becoming the dominant members of Treeline, and you're seeing really a rearrangement rather than just a shift.
It's interesting. The book is sort of a bit of a travelogue because you traveled all over the country and even to New Zealand, telling stories of some of the trees that you're following in this book, a few of these few species. One of the interesting things you found was there's a fossil record of giant sequoias in Alaska, which is thousands of miles from where we think of sequoias growing. And off the coast of Alaska, just on the coast of Alaska around Homer, Alaska, which we think of spruce country, at one point there was giant sequoias.
Right. And actually, it was a related species called metasequoia that I saw there in Alaska. But you're absolutely right that basically the broader point would be just that the makeup of species, even at relatively recent points in kind of the geological past, are pretty different, to the point where you have a forest that looks very much like, you know, the forest of the East Coast or even parts of the Midwest living in Alaska. And that's really just a function of climate. And, you know, you can see in these fossils that when the climate changes, species move to follow. I mean, they follow looking for the climates that suit them.
Now, you begin your book talking about an old species of tree called the Florida torreya, which I'd never even heard of, which on the face of it seems destined for extinction. What happened to the torreya? And you tell us this story of an amazing woman named Conley Barlow who's out to keep that from happening. So what happened to the torreya first?
So, yeah, the Florida torreya is a very rare, isolated tree. It lived just really along a dozen or so miles of the Apalachicola River in the Florida Panhandle on these kind of limestone bluffs that are a little elevated above the rest of the landscape. And so it did live there, you know, ever since there are records. But in the 1950s, it suddenly started dying off, this rare conifer. And the culprit seemed to be a fungus. And there was the question of why this fungus, why now? And the people in charge of its conservation, you know, kind of investigated the fungus, but really there wasn't, you know, they collected seeds in case it went extinct in the wild. And that's kind of where things stood in the early 2000s when this woman named Connie Barlow, who at that point was a science writer, she did a lot of speaking about what she called a evolutionary evangelism. But she visited this park and she visited these trees and she thought the real problem was not the fungus, but that the tree had gotten stuck. She thought that it should have migrated north at the end of the last ice age, but for whatever reason, it had gotten stuck there in Florida. And so this fungus, she thought, was kind of a secondary symptom, the way that polar bears in zoos will kind of sometimes grow algae on their fur if it's too warm and turn green. And so she thought the solution was really simple, just move the trees north. So that's what she did. She got a group of citizens together and volunteers, and with seeds that she acquired from botanical gardens and nurseries, sent them to volunteers across the eastern United States, and these people planted them. So that's what happened with her, and it set off this big controversy because it really ran counter to how conservation has been done in this country, which is, you know, very focused on keeping things kind of in their current arrangement.
Right, but it's also controversial for the fact that when you introduce a new species in a new area, you don't know how it's going to react with the plants, animals, everything else that is already there.
Yeah, that's right. Really, one of the favorite stories in biology is the story of unintended consequences. You know, often the story is of someone carrying a species to a new place and it escapes and it ends up doing terrible damage. So there in Oklahoma, I was just reading about this. It looks like the emerald ash borer is approaching Tulsa. So yes. This is a beetle that appeared in Michigan was first noticed in the early 2000s and has since killed millions and millions of ash trees all across the Midwest and East. And now it's spreading west. And that's a great example of someone moved this species. It turned out to be from Eastern Asia, and it's just done a huge amount of damage in this country.
You do tell the story of the ash trees and the emerald borer. How was the emerald borer discovered? You tell the story of David Roberts, who sort of was investigating these trees that were getting sick in Michigan and finally actually found the emerald borer.
Yeah, so I believe it was 2001, this plant pathologist in Lansing, East Lansing, I believe, named Dave Roberts, he got a call from an arborist at a condo community in Canton, Michigan, near Ann Arbor. And this arborist said, basically, we have some dying ash trees. Could you come take a look at them? So he went and took a look at them. And, you know, as is often the case with doctor visits, on the first visit, he couldn't really tell what was going on. But he kept his eye on it and eventually took some logs back to his lab from some ash trees that had died and been cut down, and came back to his lab a couple weeks later and found these green beetles flying around his office or his lab. And so that's how the emerald ash borer was discovered. So after that, it kind of set off this race against time in Michigan, and you had entomologists, so people who study insects. You had federal authorities, state authorities, trying to study this beetle, find out its life cycle, where it came from, what it was, and then trying to enact quarantines to stop it. And Dave Roberts caught the beginning of this invasion that we're still experiencing.
And now the emerald borer is, I think, except for Mississippi, it's in every state, say, west of Texas, Nebraska. And, of course, there are very few ash trees out west, so... And you know, Oklahoma doesn't have a tremendous number of ash trees, but say up in the upper Midwest, you know, a lot of the forests are made up of ash.
Yeah, in some forests it was a high proportion. I can't remember, maybe a third in Ohio or some places like that. You know, I was actually reading this morning, knowing I was going to talk to you, I took a look at the urban forest plan of Tulsa. It looks like actually 10% of the trees in Tulsa are ash trees.
Wow.
And apparently there's roughly 5.2 million trees. So that is,
you know, quite a few.
500,000 trees. So yeah, I mean, Tulsa could very well experience, what some parts of the Midwest have experienced. And I, you know, you have, I guess, the advantage of 20 years of, research and methods, but yeah, there's some vulnerability there, certainly.
And when I last looked at it, which was some time ago, Delaware County in far eastern Oklahoma is the only area where we've had infestations. But it's about 60, 70 miles from Tulsa, so it isn't far. Mm. And your book also talks about some of the ways in which scientists have tried to counteract this. So one is using counter pests as a solution. They used a wasp, but it really hasn't been very effective. And again, when you introduce another introduced species, you really don't know what it's going to do to other species around it, other insects, other plants and animals that interact with that introduced species to control a pest that is also introduced.
Right. So this practice of introducing a, quote, native enemy of a invasive species or exotic species is called biological control. In the book, I use a kind of older term, counter pests, which I just thought kind of had a better ring to it. but yeah, basically the idea, so for the emerald ash borer, scientists have imported, I believe, four species of parasitic wasps that they are completely harmless to humans. They're not the wasps that you'd even notice, but they attack emerald ash borers. And so they've imported these wasps and raised them and released them. And yeah, it's hard to tell how much it's done so far. One of the things they've kind of tried to lower expectations for what it will do. And right now, one of the things they're saying in the Midwest is that maybe these kind of young ash trees that haven't been attacked yet by emerald ash borer, perhaps they can, these wasps can protect those kind of young trees. But you're right, it is biological control or the release of counter pests is a controversial practice, even among, you know, entomologists, people who study insects. Again, because, as I said, one of the favorite stories in biology is the story of unintended consequences. And these things, maybe they'll attack native beetles, too. There's some evidence of that. So at a certain point, it's kind of a philosophical question. It's, what do we value? Do we value the trees so much that we're willing to risk kind of unknown consequences to other native biodiversity that is not so well known and doesn't have such a high dollar value?
You tell several stories along this where man's best intentions has done damage to what they were trying to protect. In the case of giant sequoias, it's been the suppression of fire for, you know, a couple of generations. They're not producing seedlings because they need low-intensity fire to drop the seedlings to help clear out space for new sequoias. And it looks like, you know, that is a familiar story in how we try to manage nature.
Right. You know, I think the lesson has sometimes been taken as, look at how much harm we've done trying to make things better. Maybe we just shouldn't do anything. Maybe we should be hands-off and kind of let nature take care of itself. And so a lot of the people that I write about in the book take a little bit of a different view. They're seeing these changing landscapes and changing ecosystems and kind of accepting that there is going to be change and still trying to do good and know that, you know, maybe not everything that they're doing is going to work out, but still trying to provide some solution or work towards a better future, which I was attracted to that, not being paralyzed in the face of uncertainty.
You tell some stories about several species that we think of as being virtually eliminated, the American elm, the American chestnut, you know, elms that are resistant to Dutch elm disease, and chestnuts that are blight resistant. These are species that are somewhat making a comeback in a small way compared to their numbers prior to the disease that and or fungus or whatever that decimated the populations. But what is your thought on the idea that nature can make its own way?
I think nature will make its own way. I think in a certain sense, many people have argued that, you know, our designations of invasive or native are sort of arbitrary and kind of our descriptions of, you know, pristine wilderness or as opposed to the built environments where we can see the clear footprint of humanity. Those are sort of arbitrary designations. I think there's some merit to that. I do think there's value in trying to preserve ecosystems as they exist, whether that's cultural value, ecological value. So I think there's value to that. I think that there's instances where we can sort of foresee ecosystems that we might like in the future for, again, cultural or ecological values. And so there will probably be instances where we'll want to try to help those come into shape. And then, so I think it'll be a mix. I think it'll be trying to get out of the way of nature in some cases and trying to help nature along in other cases. And I think we need to be open to that in an era of rapid change.
My guest today is Zach St. George. He's a science journalist, and his new book is titled The Journey of Trees, A Story About Forests, People, and the Future. It's a really interesting book going all over the country and around the world, really, looking at how people are trying to preserve forests, how people are investigating species that are in trouble or trying to help them migrate in the case of someone like Connie Barlow. I have to ask you, what has been the results of this idea of migrating the Florida Torreya? Is it working out?
I would say it's still a story in progress. I get regular emails from Connie giving me updates. There's people all over the eastern United States growing Florida Torreyas in their yard, on their properties. Some of those trees have grown up to produce seeds of their own, so they've sort of completed the first step in kind of the quote migration of forests. You know, I think it remains to be seen, though. Will those trees become the seeds of future forests of Torreya? I mean, it's hard to say. I guess they're creating the possibility of it.
You have met some logging of officials that, you know, in the course of managing their own forest, they decided to plant giant sequoias. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that is a fascinating story. It's the largest timber company in California. 6 or 7 years ago, they decided to create what they called a giant sequoia genetic conservation project, which again is moving the species north and upslope of its current range. And so with the permission of the managers, the state, federal, and tribal managers of the giant sequoia groves, they've gone around and collected seeds in the various groves and then planted them north and upslope on their holdings, and they have an agreement. You know, they'll basically never harvest those trees for timber, and the idea is they say is potentially they could, you know, turn those to public parks or something later.
Mm-hmm. You also found a couple locations in Quebec with some spruce forests, and a place in New Zealand where they're collecting like Monterey pines and redwoods, where they're sort of creating their own managed forests. In Quebec, they're managers who manage the forest much like a way a wildlife manager would manage game, setting harvest limits. I found that really fascinating. What was your reaction to this sort of managed forest?
I mean, managed forests are a fairly old practice, particularly in Europe, where they had pretty extensive deforestation, even going back thousands or hundreds of years. You know, it's a little like farming. It's a bit controversial. It's I shouldn't say a bit. It's pretty controversial because, of course, you're taking a pretty intensive hand in these forests, and the arguments against it are basically just that it creates lots of ecological problems and reduces biodiversity. The argument for it, of course, is that you have basically more timber in the space and kind of more efficient timber production. In Quebec, one of the interesting things they're doing is preparing for climate change. And so they're starting to plant seeds taken from further south, so collected further south. So in effect, they're planting trees that are already adapted to a warmer climate. Because you can imagine going south is one way to preview climate change.
Right.
So, like I say, there's some of the arguments between ecologists or environmentalists and foresters still apply. On this particular question of helping trees migrate, the foresters have been pretty progressive. And, you know, that's probably largely a matter of looking at their bottom line and saying the same trees in the same places are not going to work.
I didn't realize that was a monoculture. I mean, certainly in the United States, we have a lot of monoculture logged areas where it's replanted, but it's done in a monoculture fashion, which sort of eliminates the biodiversity. In the case of New Zealand, that's more of a preserve, though, right?
Actually, in New Zealand, it's very much the monoculture.
Is it?
Monterey pines. Yeah, those are non-native trees that have been planted and done really well. And they do tend to be a monoculture. In California or Quebec, it's less of a monoculture. They have a mix of trees, and those are a little bit different aims. But yeah, in New Zealand, I looked at Monterey pines, which are this rare tree from California that has really, due to human attention, had this spectacular success of traveling around the world. So that was kind of one vision of how people have moved and possibly changed the future of forests.
Do you think it's going to require a helping hand from man to help these forests and these tree species successfully change the huge number of threats they're facing from climate change, invasive species, and ecosystem change and ecosystem loss?
I think there's certainly instances where we can have a positive effect, where we can step in and do things. The bottom line with changes to the world's forests is that right now the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is at its highest level in 3 or 4 million years. And scientists project that by the middle of this century, it will be the highest it's been in 50 million years. So really, that's going to have a dramatic effect on the world's forests. We know that from the fossil record. When the climate changes, the arrangement of the world's species changes too. So the biggest effect we could have would be to reduce our emissions. And under that big solution, there's, I think there will be smaller solutions in specific instances.
What's your takeaway after this examination over the course of a few years, looking at these tree species and the people that are trying to save them or at least preserve them? What's your takeaway?
I mentioned these people are sort of looking at really huge changes. They're looking at changes in the arrangement of species and the abundance of species. And sometimes, for people who have worked in certain ecosystems or are familiar with the current arrangement of species, that can be really hard and it can be really painful. And the people that I was really attracted to and wrote about a lot were people who sort of did experience this sort of climate grief and still continue to try and work towards their solutions. Whether or not those solutions will work, whether they'll save the species, the ecosystem, whether everything will turn out okay, they're still trying. And I found that to be a really attractive sentiment. And, I think more broadly, it's safe to say that there will be trees in the future, there will be forests, and they won't be arranged the way they are now. So the question is, what role can or should people take in that rearrangement?
The name of the book is The Journey of Trees, a story about forests, people, and the future. Zach, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Science journalist Zach St. George has written for The Atlantic and Scientific American and is the author of The Journey of Trees, a story about forests, people, and the future. It's published by Norton. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.